Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything
except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW 91.7 in San Francisco, San Francisco's oldest, most innovative public radio station.
We're continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, Stanford's oldest and most innovative corner.
Yeah, there you go, John. And today we're going to talk about gender. John, I have a question for you. If you wanted to know about the biology of gender or sex, you'd go talk to a biologist. If you wanted to know about sort of cultural roles and all that stuff, you'd go talk to, I don't know, an anthropologist, a sociologist. What are we philosophers doing talking about this stuff?
Well, it's true, Ken, that in empirical issues, it's up to the scientists to make the distinctions, but it's up to the philosophers to ponder the distinctions, to contemplate the distinctions, to worry about the distinctions, to think about the social and ethical implications of the distinctions. There's plenty for philosophers to do. Don't worry, we're not going to run out of work here.
Okay. So help me ponder these distinctions. People like to distinguish between gender and sex. And help me with that. I know you have a view about.
Well, I think the view is this, that sex is a biological, pretty bipolar distinction. You've got a phallus or you don't. You've got a vagina or you don't. Social roles have become connected with these two biological categories. The social roles often vary from culture to culture, but there usually is a pattern. The female social role is the nurturing one, and the male is supposed to go out and provide and watch TV and drink beer.
But then
you've got the gender, which is physical and biological. You've got the social roles, and they don't all go together. I mean, some people with phalluses want to play the female social
role. Yeah, I know people would say that the gender roles, the social roles, are culturally constructed. I mean, they're obviously culturally variable, and they're culturally constructed, and they're not constrained by biology. I think that's one of the things we really need to dig into, because I don't buy the idea that culture just floats entirely free of biology, that biology is fixed and determinate and culture is like this plastic thing that you can make whatever you want out of. I don't quite buy that.
Yeah, there's a lot of room, though, between the idea that the culture just floats free from the biology, that the sex doesn't constrain gender at all, that there's no evolutionary explanation of gender roles at all, and the view at the other extreme, that it's very, very tightly connected, and that if we deny that women should stay at home and nurture the children, were actually violating evolutionary wisdom.
Yeah, I take your point. You know, and it also turns out, and here's something we'll have to dig into a bit, I think, because it's striking. It actually turns out that sex is a lot less fixed and bipolar than you might think. I mean, we tend to think sex has come in two kinds, men, males, and females, and there's no in-between, but it turns out that's not really the case at all, you know?
So both gender and sex are somewhat more fluid than we might have thought.
Yeah, and Amy Standen, our roving philosophical reporter, investigates the fluidity of sex. She files this report.
Most people probably assume that among human beings there are men and there are women. Not everyone sticks with the gender they were given at birth, but generally speaking, they identify as male or as female. As it turns out, there are plenty of exceptions.
I 100% identify as something different. Something in between that has all of the characteristics of both and is morphed into one being. And I don't know exactly what physically that looks like.
This is Click. Instead of the pronoun he, Click says Z. Instead of his or her, Click says hair. That's H-I-R. Click was born with a girl body, but says Z always felt somewhere in between the two genders. A few years ago, Click began taking testosterone to try and make hair outside match what Z felt on the inside.
I ended up deciding that testosterone was the right path for me, and so I was living as a man and kind of just jumped the whole in-between space. I would pass 100%. I had full facial hair and lived like that for about a year, and then really started to question gender again, very much questioned the binary aspect of where I was at, and realizing that I hadn't obtained what I wanted. I wanted to be existing in a very ambiguous state.
Since then, Click has been experimenting with testosterone levels, which can give hair that outward androgyny. It's a bit like designing a new kind of person. There's no real model other than what Click feels on the inside.
My main goal in transitioning is transitioning into something different. I don't want to, quote-unquote, become a man, and I don't want to be seen as what society sees a woman as either.
My name's David Cameron. I'm a 57-and-a-half-year-old person, and I prefer person over male or female or man or woman.
David is 6'10" tall and has a beard. He looks like a man, but appearances can be deceiving.
Well, I didn't develop like other boys when I first went through puberty. My sex glands are sort of like up inside. They're very, very tiny. At 29, I was sort of seeing this lady, and she wanted her own kids. So I thought, well, I should go have this checked out. So I actually did. I went to Stanford Fertility Clinic, and I left a specimen, and they told me I didn't have any sperm. And I was like, what? I went to the infertility clinic, and they checked me out. And about 3 months later, I get called into the doctor's office, and the guy says, well, you have an extra X chromosome. You have XXY sex chromosomes. And it's a condition called Klinefelter syndrome. And he said that I had 10% of what was considered normal testosterone levels for a male.
The doctor started David on a massive dose of testosterone. He grew chest hair, his sex drive increased, he had more energy. It was, he says, a second adolescence. But the more, quote, masculinized version of himself didn't feel quite right either.
I not only had this sexual energy, but my overall energy changed. Before I could sit and crochet for hours, you know, and be totally happy, having more energy, you want to get up and do things. You want to, you know, like, I could dig a ditch. I could do really masculine work, you know, and I did. I had my own business. But at the same time, I still had this other being in me. I was really grieving, losing that beautiful female person that I had been.
David doesn't bother with the gender-neutral pronouns. He doesn't really mind being considered a man. But on the inside, he thinks of himself as somewhere in between.
Most of our society believes that sex and gender, one's sex and one's gender, is the same thing because we live in this binary that has a two-sex, two-gender system. I know a lot of people fear, oh, well, are you saying there's more than two sexes or more than two genders? I know there's more than two sexes and more than two genders. It's just that the rest of the culture hasn't gotten it yet. I think all of us, if we really looked into our heart of hearts, we are all blends.
For Philosophy Talk, this is Amy Standen.
Well, Ken, that was quite fascinating. Thank you, Amy. I'm tempted to say, Ken, we're not in Kansas anymore. But I guess even if we were in Kansas, we'd still have to accept the fact that we're all blends.
Well, the putative fact that we're all blends. We'll see if we're all blends. We have a guest who can help us answer the question of whether we're all blends. We're joined by Professor Anne Fausto-Sterling of Brown University, where she's a professor of biology and gender studies. She's also a historian of science. She's the author of two very fine books. The most recent is Sexing the Body, and the earlier book, Myths of Gender. Anne, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Welcome, Anne. Let me ask you this question. You've been quoted as saying that there are really five sexes and not just two. What did you mean by that?
Well, that was a kind of ironic claim that I made to get people's attention, and it did. And what I wanted to say, or what I meant by that, was that there's a wider variety than this Platonic ideal of two. And some of the people who your colleague interviewed and just aired exemplify some of that variety. So I made up the number five based on some big heterogeneous medical categories.
Yeah. Let me ask you a question about that. I mean, one might think, you're the biologist, so I'm going to be guided by you. One might think that there are all kinds of, let's call them sexual abnormality. You know, there are lots of people, you know, born with XXY or XX with strange male, you know, testosterone hormones and all that sort of stuff. And there's all sorts of that. But they're like, well, we could call them abnormalities. Do they? And they might not challenge our fundamental notions of the kind of bipolarity of normal sex. Let's set aside culturally constructed gender, but let's talk biology.
Right. Well, since you're a philosopher, I'm sure you've heard of the problem of natural kinds.
Yeah, definitely.
And the question is, are there really two natural kinds and everything else doesn't fit into those two? Or are there all of the different things we see in nature, in fact, natural and not abnormal? And to a large extent, we as scientists may, or as medical professionals, make a decision about what we count as normal or not normal based on our social or cultural understandings of what we think the world should look like, rather than on anything that sort of is self-evident from nature.
And let me share with our listeners my understanding of natural kinds.
Sure.
Of course, it comes from nature, and the idea is that nature on its own produces things of various kinds. Now, that's got to be right to some extent. I mean, rocks and grass are quite different. But then elm trees and oak trees. Well, that's a pretty robust natural kind, but there's lots of distinctions among trees we make that, you know, really are pretty much just the result of the way humans breed trees. So how natural are they? And then at the other extreme, there's like the difference between Pepsi-Cola and Coca-Cola. Is that a natural kind, though? It seems like a socially constructed kind of virtually identical liquids.
Yeah, we think that, I mean, some philosophers think that nature has joints, and the job of science is to carve nature up
carve
into
nature
its pre-given
joints.
Joints, right?
That's
and
right.
And you might think that male versus female is one of biology's
right.
pre-given joints.
And as a biologist, I am not particularly convinced that nature has those joints. I think that what we do is, you know, our as biologists is our best to offer good categories that enable us to carry out research projects and enable us to understand the world. But whether those are sort of are in fact natural joints that nature that the world is carved into, or whether we're imposing them on a world that's quite a bit more complex and messy, I think is an open question, and I'm inclined to say that we're imposing order where there's some order, but less than we think meets the eye.
So the way nature works is there are statistical clumps that are quite significant that center around these pure male and pure female paradigms, and the ones in between are I guess fairly rare. But how rare are they? What percentage of 100 people would be in this somewhat ambiguous state?
Well, this of course depends on who you count as ambiguous. Now, the gentleman who was interviewed with Klinefelter's, that's primarily a chromosomal difference. If you count everybody who doesn't quite fit the so-called pure male or pure female, including at the chromosomal level, which is actually quite common, you come up with something approximating 2%, or so it would be, you know, 2 out of 100, which is actually quite high if
so
you think
out,
about it.
2 out of 100, as I understand, the Jewish population in America is roughly between 2 and 3%. That's they make a significant cultural impact. What happens to this 2 or 3%? Why are they not self-identified? Do the members of this percent know that they fit into this group?
And I'm going to let that question hang for a little bit. Then we address it in a little bit.
Okay.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking with Anne Fausto-Sterling of Brown University about sex and gender. She's just helped us to see that sex and gender are more fluid than we imagine. So here's the question for you. Should we abandon our bipolar sexual vocabulary altogether and open ourselves to a variety of new sexual kinds?
Please join us.
By giving us a call at 415-841-4334.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Philosophy Talk. The phone lines are closed.
4134.
Or send us an email at comments@philosophytalk.org.
Philosophy Talk will be right back.
Girl. The Barbarians with Are You a Boy or Are You a Girl? Boy, The Barbarians, that's a blast from the past, Ken. Brings back memories. You know, the only band I remember with a one-handed drummer.
Yeah, right.
So you talk about being willing to deal with statistical irregularities. Anyway, you're listening to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Ann Fausto Sterling of Brown University. We're talking about sex and gender. Is gender really a binary system, or is it more ambiguous than that? Give us a call and tell us what you think. We're eager to hear from you.
The number is 415-841-4134.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Philosophy Talk. The phone lines are closed.
Or email us at comments@philosophytalk.org.
So, Ann, I'm going to go back to John's question before the break, and I'll phrase it. The number of people who are of ambiguous gender, let's put it that way for the time being, intersexuals, is nearly 2%, you say. But they seem pretty invisible in our broader culture. That's a lot of people, if you take the population of the United States. Why are they so invisible?
Well, they are invisible, often, because their situation may result as a gentleman who was interviewed from a chromosomal difference that isn't even recognized until something like fertility becomes an issue. So people can grow up being different from that ideal norm and not know it until fairly late in life. The other, if kids are actually born with ambiguous genitalia or some unusual component to their gonads, then they may be diagnosed early in life. And the medical practice is to try to, quote, fix it, to make them conform and to make them invisible because of the pre-existing belief that there should only be two. So we try to make only two, even when there's not two.
So a lot of people in this intersex region probably don't know or aren't vividly aware of the fact that they were born that way, and others probably know and just try to forget it.
That's correct.
And the medical profession helps them by doing these surgeries. I mean, reading your book, it was sort of a catalog of horrors at certain times. I mean, it seemed to me.
Well, there are many of us who don't believe that the medical profession necessarily helps by doing these surgeries to correct genitalia. The surgeries are imperfect, and they're often done on babies who have no choice in the matter. So the question about whether these surgeries are necessary for the mental health of the child is a really big one, and it's one that's being hotly debated right now within the pediatric surgical world.
So look, Anne, I'm going to ask you a more philosophical question, though.
Sure.
Because I wonder what the deep, what about the rest of us who have, let's call it standard, I don't know if I want to use the word normal given what you've said, let's call it standard sort of gender and sex identities. I mean, is there any challenge to that from what you're saying? I mean, you could think of it like this, and I'm not sure if you do or don't. You could think of it like people say, well, used to say, racial categories are biological categories. That's nonsense, it turns out. And one of the reasons you can see that is because our concepts of race don't have a way, our sort of fixed ordinary concepts of race, can't deal with interracial people. It doesn't know what to call them, right? It's completely embarrassed by the phenomena of interracial people. And so you say, well, we should abandon this old race schema. Are you suggesting a similar kind of argument for gender concepts?
There is a similar kind of argument to be made, although the analogy is incomplete. But within people who have what you call the standard set of attributes, there is also huge variability in body type, in interest, in mental and physical inclination. And even in things like how deep your voice is. I mean, I have women friends who have extremely deep voices who would be always mistaken for men, and I know men who have pretty high-pitched voices. So what the things we think of as, quote, the standard, what I call the Platonic ideal, are just that. They're an ideal that don't particularly match the huge variability within our populations.
The number at Philosophy Talk is 415-841-4134. Our guest is Ann Fausto Sterling. Give us a call. Ann, let me ask a question here. with the case that Ken mentioned of people that don't fit into the standard racial stereotypes, we can say that's a very dynamic phenomenon. I mean, it's increasing in California. You know, probably the majority of people that we call minority don't fit into cleanly into any of these stereotypes, and maybe most of the people we call majority. What's the case with? Is it always going to be around 2 or 3%? Is are cultural inhibitions to recognizing the reality of this disappear? Will this number increase? Is it hereditary in any
way?
Well,
let me distinguish between intersex and then gender. The dynamics of gender. Intersex is sometimes an accident of birth. It's sometimes genetic, and as in those cases, it may have very different frequencies in different populations where a particular gene is more frequent or not. But if we go back to this notion that masculinity and femininity, both in body type and in inclination towards particular gender roles or jobs or sports, those kinds of things, represent a huge spectrum of inclinations, there I think there's a huge dynamic change taking place. And we see it both across the board, from jobs that are acceptable to women now that weren't 100 years ago, participation in athletics, to I would include in this the changing ideas about marriage. I would include in it the changing concepts of homosexuality, that despite the red states, there's been a sea change in our notion of who homosexuals are and what they do and what kind of lives they should live.
Anne, I take your point, but I want to distinguish two things and wonder how you think they interact. So you've argued in your book and elsewhere, and I find it convincing in many ways, something about the fluidity of, let's call it, biological sex, right? And then on the other hand, people talk about the cultural construction of gender roles. I mean, I don't know about the cultural construction of gender roles. I mean, I'm half convinced of that. But what follows does anything directly follow for the cultural construction of gender roles from the biological fluidity of biological sex? I mean, nothing. Does anything directly follow? I mean,
well, in other words, if we go back to this panoply of positions, there are the determinists who say, look, the biological bipolar distinction means that we need to have a bipolar social distinction. And they could say, okay, so it's not quite bipolar, so we need a not quite bipolar social distinction. That's your point, Ken.
Yeah,
it's
right. I mean, or you could think, well, the social roles and the biological roles just float free of one another.
Yet intuitively, not being so strictly philosophical, there is a sense that, gosh, even if the bipolarity of sex breaks down, that does kind of open up the doors for the bipolarity of gender roles to break down. So let's see what our guest has to say about all that.
Well, I don't think constructed roles float free. That's one thing. Nor am I a biological determinist. And in fact, I prefer, and the work I'm doing now is aimed at trying to have us understand how there's a constant kind of co-production of the body and culture. If you're a biological determinist, you think the body is fixed and then culture is layered on top of it. In fact, I think that as little children, as we're acculturated into our male or female roles and interests, that's happening via changes in our nervous system, in our body, in our brain, so that that distinction between the body and culture, I think, breaks down.
I think that's a nice point. Why don't we let some callers into this conversation? First one up is Billy in San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Billy.
Thank you.
What's your comment or question?
Well, I'm wondering, with all the laws being passed and the constitutional amendment being proposed to define marriage as between a man and a woman, what kind of can of worms is the conservative right opening up in terms of defining whether this, for example, a heterosexual couple, is he really 100% male? Is she really 100% female?
Yeah, you have to do...
The biological sex.
Yeah, that's a good question. You have to go back to the Olympics does this sex testing. You have to do that for marriage? Anne, what do you think?
Well, the Olympics gave it up. They just couldn't make it work in any way that scientists or the athletes agreed with. These kinds of cases that your caller raises, though, are already in the courts, where you have the court trying to decide whether someone is legitimately a male or whether because they've had transsexual surgery, or whether in some cases the court says, no, that person has a Y chromosome, he's a male, even if he has been legally changed to a female, including his birth certificate. So this is a can of worms, and it's already actively being played out in our legal system at many levels.
Yeah, so the conservative right is they don't know what they're getting into.
But you know, you've got people who object to the forms now that we have standard in many university and social and government practices, saying what is your ethnicity? They give you about five choices and other.
There's
all kinds of ways that forms and laws can undermine the picture of people as blends of all different sorts.
Yeah, that's certainly true. You can join this conversation by calling 415-841-4134. We're talking with Anne Fausto Sterling about gender and sex, the variability and multiplicity of all these things. We have a caller in the line now, Dave in San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Dave.
Hi. I think there's something to be learned in thinking about sex from thinking about height. Now, nobody says you can't be 7 feet tall or you can't be 3 feet tall, but people who are 5 to 6 feet tall tend to fit in better and kind of do better socially and so on. And so I think we don't take in somebody who's 7 feet tall and say, we're going to cut a foot off of your leg so you'll only be 6 feet tall. We tolerate them being 7 feet tall. But it's something they have to work with. It's a kind of a feature of their lives. And I think the same thing can be said of sex characteristics that are not, standard, I think is your word, that they present life challenges and something that the individual needs to work through.
Well, I think that's a very good point. I mean, height statistically clusters, but as you say, between 5 foot and 6 foot these days, didn't used to. And yet we deal with the fact that although there's a cluster, there's also an infinite number of possibilities. Good point.
What do you think, Anne?
Well, I think it's an interesting point because we also have structured our world. The height of water fountains, the height of the standard kitchen sink, the height of the toilet off the floor, based on that average height. Now, as for me, I'm 5'2" and I need a step stool in my kitchen because otherwise I can't use the top shelves in my cabinets. So this gentleman is right. I have to work with the fact that architects build houses for taller people than I am.
Yeah. I want to ask you, you mentioned in passing about being socialized into gender roles. And you said, I want to explore your views about this a little bit more. You're not a biological determinist, and you're not one of the people who think that sort of culture floats entirely free of biology. I want to explore that a little bit more with you, because here's something that strikes me often in these conversations. I don't know a society without some kind of division of labor between the gender, the division of reproductive labor, the division of raising children, the division of providing for the community. Everywhere you look, there's some kind of division of gender labor, let's call it. And it seems to me that that's not accidental. It has something to do with the kind of beings we are, the kind of biological beings we are. You know, there's this kind of massive coordination problem that we face as a species. Men have to coordinate with men so as not to kill each other over the women. Women have to coordinate with women so as not to kill each other over the men. And men have to coordinate with women so that mates get assigned in a way that both will agree. And it seems that part of our whole kind of being in the world is designed to solve these coordination problems. So it makes it non-accidental that there's a division of labor.
It's very hard to figure out. You're absolutely right that there is a division of labor in most, if not all, cultures that we're aware of, but it's very hard to figure out why. And you can, for example, the roles that different groups play are different in different cultures, so it's not the same division of labor. There are some fundamental things we know. Childbearing is one difference between most men, or all men, and most women. That is, not all women bear children, but no men do. And childbearing and how you then organize households around children might be one factor that leads to a division of labor. But clearly what the division of labor is not set. It's something that develops historically and changes historically.
You know, I think I don't want to correct you, but I mean, our governor Arnold Schwarzenegger gave birth in one of his movies. Of course.
Oh well, this is true.
That may not have. I'll have to check on whether that was a documentary or fiction. Yeah. But in the meantime,
and he is an amazing man.
He is an amazing man. We do have email from Kurt in Berkeley. It sounds like he's kind of supporting what Ken was saying. Something like, he says, if the standard binary codes for gender and sex aren't sufficient, what is the solution? Get rid of male, female terms and pronouns? Or can't we simply accept that there may be simply exceptions to justifiable rules? In other words, maybe we need to add a little box for other, like we do with the racial and ethnic characteristics, and learn to be more tolerant to these 1 to 2 to 3% of the people. But do we really need to change the way we look at everything?
The whole set of categories need to be reconfigured. What do you think, Ken?
Well, I think that we need to think about why we want to change categories. I don't know that we always have to, but there are some areas, for example, where maybe the categories don't make sense. For example, driver's license or passport. Do we really need to identify male or female on those? For example, if you have a woman who's very male presenting, that is, she looks very masculine, it's just her body type, and she's identified as a female on a passport, it may actually endanger her because people's first look is, oh, that's a man. And then they say, what the heck is going on? And but do we really need to identify male or female at all on a passport or on a driver's license? So there, maybe we can just let the categories go. What's important for identification is probably height and eye color and hair color and body weight, those things, and, you know, maybe in some future retinal pattern, some world of the future retinal pattern.
You know, it strikes me that actually reading your book convinced me, in some ways, biology has already abandoned the bipolar, because you can't explain the biological regularities and the biological systematicity without appeal to a more articulated set of categories. I mean, you can't describe these syndromes without, you know, going down a level and talking about genes and hormones and all that
right.
kind of stuff.
Right, that's absolutely right. When I or anyone else lectures to a group of embryology students or a group of medical students, we don't talk about sex as one thing. We talk about sex at 6 or 7 or 8 different levels, starting with chromosomes and then things that are going on in the fetus and then things that happen at birth and then at adolescence. And each of these is referred to as a kind of sex. So the biologists understand that there's a more complex underlining story.
Yeah. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing sex and gender with Anne Fausto-Sterling, professor of biology and gender studies at Brown University.
Coming up, we'd like to imagine a sex gender utopia. What would it be like? How would we think of these things if we weren't dragged down from bipolar preconceptions of the past? Would all cultural distinctions between the gender disappear, or would we have to reinvent pretty much what we've got now? Join us by calling 415-841-4134.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Philosophy Talk. The phone lines are closed.
Philosophy Talk, we'll be right back.
The Village People with Macho Man. This is Philosophy Talk, and I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're talking gender with Anne Fausto-Sterling of Brown University. We'd like you to join our conversation. You can do so by giving us a call, 415-841-4134.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Philosophy Talk. The phone lines are closed.
Or you can email your thoughts to comments@philosophytalk.org.
So, Anne, I want to ask you a question about socialization again. I want to go back to that just briefly. Look, I've read in lots of literature, you know, that actually, who's responsible for gender socialization? You might think, well, parents, the schools, teachers, the broader community. But it looks like The people who are most responsible for it are the kids themselves. Boys like to play with boys. Girls like to play with girls, prefer to play with girls. The style of play is different. Boys won't let girls integrate into their groups very easily. Girls let boys integrate into their groups more easily. And despite parents' and teachers' best efforts, young children segregate themselves into gendered specific groups, and they do this all around the world. So it seems like this, you know, gender segregation is somehow built into us by, at least partly by nature. I mean, it's partly cultural because, you know, the play styles vary from culture to culture, but this division, it seems pretty nearly universal. What do you think about that?
I think it's hard to argue from the universal. That's one thing. Because something's universal doesn't mean it's biological. The phenomenon you're talking about begins to show up in kids at about 2.5 or 3 years of age.
Right.
By that time, they've already developed quite a lot. And let me give you another example of a so-called well-established sex or gender difference, that of language. It seems that girls, at least in U.S. culture, by the age of 2.5, say, are talking sooner, have more words in their vocabulary, and are, you know, just better chatters already. And so you say, it's biological because it happened so young. But it also turns out that parents from the day of birth talk more to girl children than they do to boy children. They look them in the eye more, they chatter more to them, they have more conversations with them. So one presumes that there's a kind of spiral development going on, a kind of systematic development where differences do emerge at interestingly young ages, 2-3 years of age, and they can remain quite fixed for the rest of someone's life, but they don't emerge in a vacuum, the genes speaking from the soul or anything like that. They emerge as a response as a product of a continual interaction between the social and sensory world.
And I get your point. I'm not sure. We could argue back and forth about this for a while. We got a caller, I think, who wants to get in on this point here. Dee Dee in San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Dee Dee.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to make the point from the standpoint that I live mostly in a community of bisexual polyamorous families who work very hard to not have specific gender roles and ways of raising their children. And what I've noticed is that children brought into that atmosphere after they're quite, you know, have maybe 6, 7, 8 years old, still hold on to those gender roles they were raised with that were strongly male versus female. And the children who seem to be born into the community already and are raised with this, without this set, this is what boys do, this is what girls do, adapt so much better into just being who they are as opposed to trying to fill specific roles. Case in point, I know of one little 8-year-old boy who knows he's a boy, feels strongly that he's a boy, who has no problems with running around in dresses and fairy costumes and just enjoying being himself and what he likes. And my own children, having come into this, my oldest one still struggles some because she wants to feel stronger in being a stronger girl.
Dee Dee, that's a very good point from an interesting perspective. I want to just push on a little more and then ask you. Suppose we really just didn't distinguish between boys and girls from day one any more than we do between brunettes and blondes. We didn't have different pronouns. We didn't have different costumes. We didn't have pink for girls and for boys. I mean, is that a possible way of living? And do you think sex and gender would reemerge if we did that as important things, or you think they could just be more or less forgotten?
Anne, what do you think?
I think I don't know the answer to that. I think that there are some early differences between, your average boy and girl. I mean, for example, at 3 months of age, boys have a testosterone surge that girls don't have. I don't know how that would affect neural activity, for example. But I do think that I do think that there's also a huge variability within each group, so to the point where the different groups overlap. So whether some new sort of binary would emerge or whether what you'd have are new groupings that emerge that have some boys and girls in one group and some other rather different feeling boys and girls in another group, I just think it's unclear and probably practically impossible to find the answer to.
So on unclarity and ambiguity, we'll bring the discussion to
we'll have to say goodbye to you. I know you need to get going in, and it's been really a great pleasure having you. Our guest has been Professor Anne Sterling of Anne Fausto Sterling, author of Sexing the Body. Thank you for joining us on Philosophy Talk, Anne.
You're very welcome.
Thanks a lot, Anne.
You're welcome.
So, John, what did you learn today?
Well, as usual in philosophy, what you learn is mostly what you unlearn.
Yeah, right.
Right? Philosophy is mostly a matter of learning that the way you look at the world is a little more rigid than it should be, it's painful, but somebody's got to do it.
Well, and we do it with pleasure here on Philosophy Talk. You know, I think this is really fascinating stuff. The fact that if you look at the biology of it, you find this kind of continuum, you know. But our social categories are kind of bipolar, and should we give it up in light of that or not? Or should we resist the continuum? I don't know. These are interesting questions.
I don't know. My big hobbies when I was a kid were crocheting hot pads and football.
There you go.
And the only thing I can say is I wasn't much good at either of them.
Yeah, you reflect the multiplicity of...
incompetence.
Incompetence, yes. John. I think this has been a good discussion. I wish we could have had slightly more time for callers and for Anne Fausto Sterling. I mean, some of you called, didn't get a chance to get in because it was a brief thing. But, you know, you can learn more about this by visiting our excellent website, www.philosophytalk.org. All kinds of information will be up there.
Holly came from Miami, FLA, hitchhiked away across USA. Plucked her eyebrows on the way, shaved her legs, and then he was a she. She says, hey, babe, take a walk on the wild side. Said, hey, honey, take a walk on the wild side.
Ken, seen any good movies lately?
Yeah, John, I just saw a movie I really like, Kinsey, you know, the sex guy.
I remember Kinsey, and I remember when those books came out.
I
was a kid. I saw the movie, too. I thought it was a fine movie, but was there anything particularly philosophical about it?
I think it was a pretty philosophical. I don't know if there was much philosophical content in the movie. You know, it wasn't trying to make a philosophical point, but I think it's a movie one can think about with the tools of philosophy fruitfully.
Well,
that's what I think.
Okay, so do a little fruitful thinking for me, Ken.
Yeah,
convince
fruitful.
Me.
So what's this movie basically about? It tells the story of Kenzie's life. He's got a very religious father, and his father railed against sexuality and all sorts of things. So he's a very repressed person who bought all this stuff.
Right, but then he doesn't immediately go into sex research. First, he thinks about gall wasps and collects more gall wasps than anybody's ever collected anything. And he's a very successful. He's a professor at Indiana University. And then one day, for reasons that are too complicated to explain, he's asked to teach a course on human sexuality.
Yeah, and that just leads to an explosion. Because in the time he's teaching this course, nobody, the general public anyway, and not very much scientific research, nobody knows anything about sex, about human sexuality. Nobody knows a thing about it. It's all this mythology and religion and ideology, and there's no real science.
Well, so there's some philosophy themes there. Knowledge is good, so forth and so on. But what really bothers you philosophically about it?
Well, I've got to tell a little bit more of the story to get the thing that interested me philosophically about this. First, he's an entomologist. He studies insects. And nobody cares. And then shortly thereafter, he turns his scientific powers onto human sexuality. And he's one of the pioneers to do this. And he does it not just out of idle curiosity, but he does it with a real passion, with real vigor and a vision of, like, educating the world and undermining all these archaic, ignorant practices. So look what's happening there. First, we have science as this thing distant from human life. That's boring and unengaging, but interesting to a curious mind, but only to a few curious minds. And then we have science turned on the on human sexuality and human beings themselves. And once we turn science onto human sexuality and human beings themselves, what happens? We undermine our previous cultural practices. Science is this destruct. It's both bringing new information and new light to bear, right? But it's also destroying archaic cultural practices. So science as this potentially progressive reformist thing, right? I mean, so there's at least two different visions of science.
There's really two vision, different visions of truth. There's this old saying, know the truth will make you free. And you see a woman who's, by reading Kinsey's second human sexuality book, the on the human female, and realizing that her own urges were things that lots of women had, came to grips with her own lesbianism, and it changed her life for the better. And she learned the truth from Kinsey, and the truth made her free and made her life better. But for Kinsey and his inner circle, it's looks like knowing the truth, namely the wide variety of sexual behavior that people engage in that has nothing to do with marital vows, made them free at any rate, but it didn't make them happy. It made them miserable. It destroyed maybe some of the beliefs that maybe are necessary to cope with something as powerful as human sexuality.
Yeah, I think that's an important point, actually. Kinsey, in this exploration, learns about homosexuality, and he starts rating his own homosexual tendencies, even though he's a lifelong heterosexual, and he realizes he has some tendencies of homosexuality, and he has his young research assistant, who's a gorgeous guy, and he's naked in front of him one day, and that begins a homosexual affair, right? He goes home and tells his wife about it, and she's just crushed. And he says one of the most inane things. He says to his wife, who's crushed by his homosexual affair, that, you know, it doesn't mean anything for our love, because not all acts of sexuality have to be sanctioned by love, right? You can have sex without love. And, you know, you're attracted to other men. Well, you could go have sex with other men or other women or whatever, because he's into this exploration. And she's just crushed. And she says, the reason I don't have sex with other men, because even though I'm attracted with them, is because I love you, because that's part of our marriage.
It's something peculiar about this scene in that Kinsey, in a way, has turned into his father, or kind of a kaleidoscopic rearrangement of the same parts. His father believes that sex is base and would be a debasement of love. Kinsey similarly has separated sex from love. It's not debased. It's not something you shouldn't do, but it's a completely casual thing. It's got no more significance for your love life and your commitment to your partner than, you know, playing pinochle instead of bridge.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
right. But see, this is another thing I think is another sort of message about the nature and limits of science, because Kinsey says at one point, well, he doesn't study love because that's something you can't measure. That's something mysterious that's not subject to scientific investigation. So he just investigates sexual behavior. But he also goes on this crusade to reform the sex laws, you know, laws that prohibit sodomy between married people. He wants to change people's thinking about what a perversion is and what isn't. Now, that's not a scientific endeavor. He's trying to build new cultural formations. He does that sort of out of his science, but his science doesn't really give him any basis for saying, here's how we should live, rather than this way. I mean, I think the movie represents that science can undermine archaic formations based on ignorance, but it can't tell you what to put in its place. And there's a scene where one of his funders says, you're acting like a preacher or a moralizer. That's not your job.
Ken, you've convinced me there's something philosophically quite important about this movie, and in a way, it doesn't have much to do with sex. It just has to do with science having this role of undermining a lot of the beliefs that hold culture together, for good or ill, but not really dictating what to put in its place.
Right. That's as it should be in some ways, right? Because it's not the business of science to make culture. It's the business of us to take science as an input to our formation of culture, but it's the business of human beings living their lives, doing politics, thinking philosophically to build culture. So I thought, yeah, you know what? This movie says what's missing is philosophy, because now we got to build a cultural formation.
K, Ken. It's fun talking about movies, but it's also fun to help our listeners talk about the philosophical problems that arise in our own life.
Yeah, if you've got a conundrum, you can send us an email at conundrums@philosophytalk.org. We won't promise to solve your problem, but we will give you lots of new ways to think about it.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Minella Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University.
Our executive producer is Gordon Earle.
Special thanks to Dave Fusaro, Nicole Sawaya, Roman Mars, and Alan Farley.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Hoover Institution, the Greenwald Foundation, and the Pacific Division of the American Philosophical Association.
Also from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and the members of KALW Information Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, www.philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.